Support for PrayPublic is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a visit about forming healthy relationships with people with different backgrounds from us, as we hear from the executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Dakotas and Minnesota. But we are going to start today with the fact that it is officially time for the dog days of summer now that the solstice is past. And there are some great ways to beat the heat and have fun in a multi-generational kind of way. Today, we hear from travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson, and she brings in an expert guest in summer fun this time, her 11-year-old son, Eli. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
And our special guest, Eli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
So the rest of us have been calling it summer since Memorial Day weekend, but meteorologically speaking, it's only just now become summer with the recent summer solstice. And that, of course, means longer days, hotter weather, and hotter bodies. We need to stay hydrated. We need to stay cool. So, Alicia, you're taking us swimming today, and especially some good kid-approved swimming spots.
Absolutely. I have an expert along with me. And this is kind of the time of year, I feel like, as Midwesterners, we rejoice in those first two hot days. Mm-hmm. And then by really scorching day number three, we're kind of looking for ways to cool off immediately. And I think as we get older, we sort of forget that we can do all those fun kid things. Like, there's great joy in splashing in the sprinkler. Yeah. So, again, yes, that is a short-term solution.
My mother
is
fond of saying youth is wasted on the young.
Absolutely.
And kids, that we should be having some fun.
Kids know how to do it. So I encourage people, think like a kid. Think about the pools and the lakes and the water parks and all those wonderful, cool, refreshing things that you can do in the summer.
Eli, are you more of a pool person or a lake person?
I don't know. It depends on which pool or lake you're talking about. Like, if you have lakes, I'd probably like, I don't know, I'd prefer lakes, actually.
Okay, and why lakes?
I think lakes are just have that natural aspect to them that just makes them very different from pools.
So you want to see the trees, you want to see the fish. It doesn't bother you if something's like going to land on you afterwards, like a leech. Yeah. No, I mean, those are just kind of cool, actually, if you pull them off right away.
We go to Detroit Lakes a lot with my parents.
So
that's
so much.
Detroit
leeches,
Lake is,
yeah.
You know, Big Detroit's pretty clean, mm-hmm. not too weedy, not too many leeches, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, Alicia, help us out here. When you are with little kids and at a lake, sometimes there's a designated swimming area and sometimes there's not. Do you only, with kids, suggest the designated swimming areas?
I do, especially if you don't have strong swimmers in your group. If you have life jackets on, then that is a little bit less pressure. And I encourage people, if you're not sure mm-hmm. how everybody in your party is doing, if you've got some weaker swimmers, older or younger, or maybe kids a couple years younger than Eli here who are real confident but might not have the strength and endurance to match, put the life jacket on and that gives you a little bit of flexibility. But those cleared out swimming beaches, they are clear, they are clean, they are cleaned up, they're the safest, they don't have any weird drop-offs, you might not have any strange wakes to worry about or sharp rocks, that kind of thing. So there's just less to worry about in that situation. And usually there's plenty of room. Public access might be close for boats, but they're not going to be right on top of you, which is good. And it's kind of a nice way for people to go out and explore. That said, we have waded in plenty of places that aren't strictly swimming beaches. We were just in Seattle and Eli was skipping rocks into the water and we were sitting on some driftwood and it wasn't specifically marked for swimming and they recommended not swimming, but it was perfectly fine to put your feet in and cool off. And it was unseasonably warm for Seattle, so it was nice. Even if you just put your feet in, neither of my grandmas swim, but they have both told me many times how much it helps. Just to, you know, put your legs in up to about your ankles or knees makes a really big difference. And you've got to be mindful of that, especially when you're out maybe walking or sightseeing or you know, checking out different things that you might need that ability to cool off, not just to drink water, but immerse yourself in it as needed.
A little closer to home than Seattle here. Where are you and Eli off to this summer for swimming holes, especially the natural ones?
Well, there's a couple different options. We live near Minnesota, so the land of the lakes is where a lot of people think of first. But I always encourage people to check out North Dakota State Parks. There are, if you can't afford the very affordable admission to get in, there are passes available at local libraries all over the state, so you can get in and check out all these different spaces. Lots of them have, you know, kayak and canoe rentals if you're not a swimmer, but you like fishing or you want to be out on the water in another way. Some of the obvious ones have lake in the name, Lake Sakakawea, Beaver Lake, Lake Mitigoshi, that kind of a thing.
Sure.
Others, Graham's Island is fantastic up on Devil's Lake.
I'm almost sad to hear you say this because that's one of my favorites and I want to keep it a secret.
But we're here to share people.
But I love this one, especially around a full moon because they have just a beautiful lakeside opening. And in just a couple minutes drive, you can get far enough away from other land that it's almost possible to not see or hear other humans.
Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes you need that magic, that big body of water.
Yeah.
Fort Stevenson also has a great kind of expansive bit of water, too. And one of my favorites, Lewis and Clark State Park, kind of out near Williston. It's near Epping. Lake Sakakawea out there feels like the ocean. I mean, we were out swimming. Eli swam there with his cousin, and I mean, there were practically white caps on this really hot day, and we just felt like we were swimming in the wilderness, and it was such a fun experience. And just the absolute opposite of that typical, very touristed lake experience. So there's a whole range, and they're all available, you know, a day trip or a short drive for people.
Eli, what are some of your favorite things to do with your cousins and stuff when you don't have to be with mom and dad?
Well, when we're, like, in the lake, just kind of, we love swimming, going under the water. One of our personal favorites is, like, just catching fish.
Oh, nice.
And, yeah, just a bunch of this, like, normal, like, swimming, all of that good stuff.
All right, Alicia, this past weekend, I was driving through Detroit Lakes, and all of a sudden, there's a great big troll, and there is this artist who is quite famous for using recycled and otherwise trash materials and building, in this case, giant woodland troll creatures that also have some storytelling elements to them. You can be following along and trying to solve these clues. Talk a little bit about these family-friendly activities that also encourage a little bit of brain work, you know, when you make learning so that the kids don't realize they're learning.
I love this. I know adults that have gone to see these trolls. They're by Danish artist Thomas Dambo, who's done installations all over the country. He's done
all over the world.
Yeah, all over the world. 138 of these giant trolls and other figures that are made from recycled materials, often from the community that they are built in. So there's a very local connection there. They're in 17 countries now, in 19 states in the U.S. The ones in Detroit Lakes are the first sculptures in Minnesota. And they're made by 17 members of Dambo's team and 400 local volunteers. So it's a huge amount of work.
Wow.
And people might be like, why does this matter? But what's neat about them is they are permanent. They're going to be maintained. So this isn't just like a one-time installation thing. And they are, like you mentioned, sort of a magical scavenger hunt. He talks about he creates these mirrors that he has as kind of a metaphor for portals. And there are riddles, and you're supposed to be following from one to the next. So the first one that people will see is right in the main park in town, so people can stumble upon it. And then if they want, they can follow the clues from Detroit Lake City Park to all these other trolls. And I love that. We do a lot of that when we travel, and I write a lot of stories that are about family travel for people that maybe don't want to be limited to just Disney or kids' cruises or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I think kids and adults really enjoy is working together, you know, being outside. As Eli mentioned with the lakes, you have that natural element. You can run off a lot of energy. If kids run and scream when they're little, it's in a park. That's what they're supposed to be doing, right? Whereas when they get a little bit older.
Yes, please stop screaming in the house.
Indeed. But running off that energy outside in the lake or in the park is great. And then as they get a little bit older, they can add their brain power to solving the riddles. And I would say, too, if you're not a water person, you're more of a, I would like air conditioning in the summer sort of person, you can do something similar to this treasure hunt in Detroit Lakes by doing a escape room. And we have done that with groups. And it's always better, I think, to do the maximum amount of people. And it's always better to have a range of ages and talents because we did it, speaking of Eli's cousins, with the aunts and cousins. And there were so many times that we were stuck. And Eli and his youngest cousin that's the same age would literally be down on the floor looking at something and see something that we truly could not see.
It's hard to get down on the ground.
Right. They were physically shorter. So I think there's a good lesson there that when you're out doing these puzzles, or maybe you're doing like West Fargo has a big scavenger hunt every year, or you're doing the escape rooms, or you're doing some brain teasers together. Like there's so many ways that you can enjoy yourself as a family or enjoy yourself as a multi-generational experience without limiting yourself to things that are just marketed to kids.
Sure.
Because kids love them, but sometimes adults are about ready to be done after 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Eli, are there ever times on these big family trips where you're kind of like, ugh, hurry up, Grandma?
There are many times and I'm like, it's just like, I think kids are so fast-paced with things.
Yeah.
And like, not trying to be mean, but older people are kind of slower, but you kind of got to pick up the pace here.
True.
Eli, you are my new favorite guest of all time. We are visiting today with a travel writer, Alicia Underlee Nelson. You can follow her at prairiestylefile.com. We are talking about ways to have fun and stay cool in the summer, and she has brought an expert guest along with her 11-year-old son, Eli. Eli, we've been talking a little bit about lakes and about these treasure hunts. Now we're going to move on to pools and to water parks. Okay, I can tell by your face you're fairly excited we're going in this direction. What do you look for at a water park?
Me personally, I just look for the tallest slide I see. I look for the tallest slide I see and tell myself, this is going to happen. If it doesn't happen, I'm going to be ashamed of myself. This is going to happen.
So you're never afraid. You are always just like, nope, we're doing it.
No, because I feel like I'll be mad with myself if I don't.
Okay, Alicia, sometimes our kids do things that make us a little scared. How do you deal?
I tell myself as long as he meets the weight requirement, there's not a lot I can do. And this truly happened. We took a family trip. If we're talking water parks, I mean, the ultimate in the Midwest is Wisconsin Dells.
Yeah,
we took a family trip with my parents and the cousins last summer.
Plus, the parents can get new Galeras beer sold only in Wisconsin.
That's true. Definitely pick that up.
Cheese curds.
And I totally expected that I would not enjoy this experience, but it turned out, because it just seemed like it would be a lot of waiting in line on hot asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe wouldn't be worth it, but it turns out it was great and we had a fabulous time. But there were some points where he went on some slides that were, I mean, they terrified me. We screamed our heads off the entire way down. But you know what?
He's laughing pretty hard at
the physics of it are in his favor. There's nothing much I can do. And at least right now he is still a little bit, doesn't weigh quite enough for the ones that drop you straight down in Wisconsin Dells.
Oh, yeah.
So my terror.
You got to eat more broccoli and spinach if you want to.
I got to drink more milk for that.
Okay.
We're a household that believes in science. And if the scientists that set up the ride say he can ride it, well, you know what? I got to relinquish little control. That's what parenting is. He's getting older. I can deal with it.
Eli, do you like scaring your mom?
Yeah, I like scaring my mom. It's pretty fun. She gets so nervous when I do these things, and it's hilarious.
He is not lying. He is absolutely correct.
Yeah, they are. It's almost like this is how we get our cardio as mothers, is our heart rates are always going, watching our kids almost hurt themselves all the time.
But it's good, though, because it pushes our own boundaries, too. And, I mean, there are so many options to explore water parks that you don't have to drive all the way to Detroit Lakes if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things here in North Dakota that can challenge you in the same way.
Yeah.
And Then the biggest risk that he faces is hearing me scream all the way down a water slide and being super embarrassing.
He's got a great eye roll. Let's talk about some of these water parks that are attached to hotels. Do you have to stay at a hotel to get that water park, or can you usually get just a water park pass?
So for some of the biggest ones, you can definitely purchase a day pass, or even in some cases an evening pass or a seasonal pass. So the big one that I'm thinking of right now, Splashers of the South Seas, which is in Grand Forks, currently open Wednesday through Saturday, but you know, in July and August they will be open pretty much, you know, every day. Mm-hmm. That's 40,000 square feet of water fun. So it's madness, right? I mean, obviously they want to open that up to as many people as they possibly can. There's a lazy river, a ton of slides, yeah. Restaurants on site, arcade. You can rent a cabana. I mean, you can spend the entire day here, and they want you to. That's the goal. So that's always available, whether you're staying there or not. And there are discounts for Grand Forks residents Monday through Thursday, which is huge. I didn't know that. 20% off is a big deal.
That's so a big deal.
Yeah, if you have a family, that's really important. So if you're a Grand Forks resident, go, for sure.
All right, Alicia, you used the word madness, and then you said, you know, 40,000 square feet of slides and arcades and restaurants and screaming kids. How are you staying sane doing all this? That's the decibel level alone in some of these places.
Well, I guess I don't really mind it. And if it bothers you, then you can always do maybe a kind of a outdoor pool, so you don't have the tinny sound of screaming voices echoing and bouncing all over the building, which can be kind of nice. So there are a lot of pools that I think are enjoyable that have a couple water slides that give the kids the thrills that they want, but maybe aren't quite as loud for the parents and caregivers, which is nice. So, I mean, we talk a lot about Davies Pool here in Fargo, which is a blast, and that has two really fun slides, including one that's very steep. And that's the one that I was thinking of when I mentioned that I screamed my way all the way down it. It's never so sad as when you're screaming and you jump off and the 16-year-old lifeguard looks at you like, wow, really? And I'm like, that's scary. He's like, not really. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. I'm officially old, apparently.
Yeah, that's definitely.
I have lost my jaded veneer. I'm terrified anew.
Also, the inner eardrum thing changes as you get older.
Yeah, I used to be the one that would ride the rides at the fair. I'd get the wristband and be on the same ride if it was a slow Tuesday, you know, 10 times in a row.
All day.
Now I ride the Tilt-A-Whirl and have to lie down for 3 hours. It's getting older is no fun that way.
Eli, do you ever go on those, like, obstacle courses that they sometimes set up in the water parks?
Oh, yeah, the obstacle courses in water parks. Yeah, those are extremely fun because, like, you have that, you're still going through the obstacle course, but with water at the same time.
So are you slipping, sliding, falling off? Like, what's your secret to making it through these things?
Jump, dive, stay on balance.
Now, Alicia, if I'm not mistaken, there is a pretty big one of these out in Watford City.
There is indeed, and I've actually been meaning to go to it forever. It's great. It's the Rough Rider Center in Watford City. It has a slide, it has a lazy river, water basketball and volleyball, so lots of activities everybody can do. But the inflatable obstacle course sounds like so much fun. And there's a few things like this in Fargo. Like, Davies has a climbing wall, and that's fun in the water. I mean, you get wet and you have that extra level of challenge. But I think it's kind of fun to add a little bit more adrenaline rush for those older kids and adults that might want to try some of these things, too.
You know, I was out in Medora last summer, and I got into a conversation with a few people who were really working on planning the future of Medora. And obviously, they've got kind of the older crowd figured out with the Medora musical and with their dining options. And then the really adventurous people going out on the Matahay Trail with the hiking and then the fat tire biking. And they were working on trying to get a little bit more younger stuff. They were getting the mini golf thing, and then they had this, like, above ground trampoline thing. It was like concave, convex, whichever one comes above ground.
That's the jump pillow.
Yeah, the jump pillow. There we go. Talk a little bit about, Alicia, as you are traveling with kids and then for you doing multi-generational stuff so often, what are some of the things that you really look for of, okay, My 0 to 5 year old kids are going to be okay. My 5 to 10 year olds, 10 to, you know, whatever, 10 to 18 is maybe too big of a range there. But specifically in trying to get those young kids, you know, not just dropped off at the daycare.
Well, I think the most important thing is to come up with an itinerary that has something for everyone. And that sounds like a cliche. But not everybody's going to be able to do their first choice all the time. But if there can be something on the docket that will appeal to every age group in the day, that will help tremendously. So if you're going to do the hike, great. You're going to pick a time. If you're out in Medora, it gets extremely hot in the afternoon, so you're probably going to be hiking morning or evening.
And so there is no shade.
Right. So maybe you're hiking in the morning, and then Grandma and Grandpa really want to go to the musical at night. That leaves you the afternoon. And I think Medora's done a wonderful job of adding exactly those attractions that you just mentioned, because there wasn't really a lot for young families. There was the fun play structure. There was the old mini golf course, which was fun. But if you go to Medora for more than a couple days, you were a little bit tapped out. Now they have the fantastic jump pillow. They've got an expanded play area, which is good. They also have the zip line, which we went down, and Eli can speak to, and that was super fun.
They have a zip line?
They do.
What? Eli, tell me all about this.
Well, it's not like, it's like an open, it's like you're in a carriage situation. So go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, you're okay. In like a little carriage, and you basically get zipped up on this platform, and there's like a really, really tall pole, and you go down to it, and then you're really high up. You can see all the views of all the mountains, and it's really nice.
Nice. Were you scared at all?
A little bit. It's a little high at first, and then you look at all the mountains, and you're like, okay, this is high.
Yeah.
But then you come back down, and the stop is a little like, oh, no. Like, the stop's like kind of a hard stop, but it's really fun in general.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Eli, what else are you most looking forward to for your summer travels?
I don't know. Like Mom touched on, like, the Wisconsin Dells, I don't know. Mainly just water parks, fun, and all stuff like that.
Okay.
We are trying the Veterans Memorial Pool in West Fargo. We have the cousins come over for a few days every summer, and we try to always explore a new body of water of some kind. And this one has some slides and a splash pad, which is fun. And they're a little bit old for the splash pad, but I have found that everybody kind of likes being able to get their feet wet, like I mentioned, and splash around here, and just anything that gives, like, all ages a little ability to run around and not to have that unstructured time, I think is fun.
Yeah.
Because whenever you've got, like, the cousins have big personalities, we have big personalities, we have lots of fun stuff we want to do, we have lots of cool things we want to accomplish in the day, and I think that is pretty common when you're on vacation as well. Like, you want to maximize all the time.
Yeah.
But anytime you can be in water or in nature, you can have, you know, a few hours where people can split up and do whatever they want. And I think allowing kids that freedom to roam and kind of arrange what they want to do in a supervised environment is super cool.
Travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson, follow her at prairiestylefile.com, and her special expert guest, her 11-year-old son, Eli. Thanks to you both for joining us for Main Street today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And I hope you both have a wonderful summer.
You too.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Main Street, we hear from the executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Dakotas and Minnesota as he joins Prairie Public CEO and Prairie Pulse host, John Harris, for the Prairie Pulse television show. That's coming up right after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Welcome back to Main Street on this Monday at Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show, host John Harris interviews Steve Hunnigs, the executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. They discuss the role of the JCRC in promoting civil rights and Holocaust education and the history and contributions of the Jewish community in the region.
Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure. Congratulations to the station on 60 years of service. to the area.
Thank you for that. Well, thanks for joining us today, as we said. And as we start off, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and maybe your background.
Sure. Again, Steve Huntigs. I'm the executive director, as you said, the JCRC of Minnesota and the Dakotas. It's my great pleasure to serve along with my wonderful staff and our board, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, as I like to call it, 225,000 square miles of paradise, right? Red River Valley, of course, is hinterland between Minnesota and North Dakota. It's a very important part. Keep in mind, here in North Dakota, we have Synagogue B'nai Israel in Grand Forks, Bethel here in Fargo. So we're deeply involved in activities in North Dakota. We do a lot of work in civil rights. We hold the responsibility for social service agencies and lobbying for the Minnesota Jewish Social Service Agencies, Holocaust education, community security. Got a staff of 11 people based in Minneapolis, but as I said before, we're often in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Some of our programs have a national reach, which is terrific. So we have a national organization, and we lobby the members of the federal delegation, six senators. I like to say we have responsibility for 6% of the United States Senate, members of Congress, the legislatures of the three states. Wonderful work.
What about the Jewish American Heritage Month? What's that all about?
President Biden every year signs a proclamation for it when he's president, and he says, this year we're dedicated to, in Jewish American History Month, talking about the values, contributions, work that American Jews and its impact have contributed to the United States. And that's really important to remember what the American Jewish community has contributed. 1654, 23 Jews came from Holland, the Netherlands, to what was then New Amsterdam, which became New York. Some of those from that really humble John beginning, grew this wonderful expanse of American Jewish community. It's all about democracy, right? I mean, one reason Jews have seen this as such a wonderful place is democratic opportunity, democratic values. After all, what does democracy mean? It means people have an opportunity to rise, right? On their own merits, working hard together with people. I like to tell people that there's never been a better time to be a Jew practically anywhere in the world than the United States in 2024. And I say that, two thoughts can occupy your mind at the same time. Despite issues with anti-Semitism, even rising anti-Semitism, even punctuated by violence such as we had at the Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, because both are true at the same time. And I tell people, because of my work, because of our team's work, travel all over the place. And I can tell you that philo-Semitism, that is the fancy word for people who want to partner with the Jewish community, work with the Jewish community, is far more prevalent than anti-Semitism, which is the good news, right? That said, we do have issues with anti-Semitism now. So, life is ambiguity. Life is trying to make sense of the internal contradictions. That's a lot of what we do. But at the end of the day, American democracy is one of our most important values and something that we all need to defend.
How many Jewish people are there in Minnesota and the Dakotas?
Yes, I like to say sort of on a good day, maybe 50,000 in Minnesota, perhaps 1,000 combined between North Dakota and South Dakota. But keep in mind, our communities in South Dakota and North Dakota are very well integrated into the social life of both states. We've had many important leaders come out of both South Dakota and North Dakota. Let's think about North Dakota for a second. Herschel Laskowitz, state senator responsible for so much of urban renewal in Fargo in the 1960s and the 1970s, sort of as a national leader, and made Fargo a national leader. Judge Myron Bright from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, right, served for decades on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals, of course, is the level of the court next highest to the Supreme Court. He served so long, he was the last member of the federal judiciary who was appointed by Lyndon Johnson, right? So his influence, right, from writing all those opinions in three-judge panels will last for years and years and years. And, if you got to know Judge Bright, what a character he was, too. But he's just sort of an exemplar of, remember my point about democracy, how is it that he rose to the Eighth Circuit? Well, it's because he made a lot of friends, made a lot of alliances in North Dakota politics over the years. He was a wonderful lawyer. And those sorts of characteristics made it possible for him to be appointed to the Eighth Circuit.
And you talked about how many were in Minnesota and Dakotas. Are most of those in the Twin Cities, though?
Sure, we have the significant majority. But keep in mind, remember I mentioned there were synagogues in Fargo and Grand Forks, synagogues in Sioux Falls, synagogue all the way over in Rapid City. Rochester, Duluth, throughout the Twin Cities, and Minneapolis and St. Paul in the suburbs. Interestingly enough, the Jewish community used to be far more widespread in terms of smaller towns in the Dakotas as well as Minnesota. Over time, the influence of the universities or influences of getting jobs, people tended to gravitate towards the larger cities.
Yeah, you mentioned coming over in 1654, I think. But how and why did Jewish people settle in Minnesota and the Dakotas?
Any number of reasons. You know, first families would come. The Minnesota-Dakotas tradition was like much the rest of the United States. First came the German Jews, right? 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, highly educated. Some of them leaving the tumult of mid-19th century Europe, the German revolutions of 1848. And they settled here, significantly a mercantile class, educated people, small numbers, you know, St. Paul, Mount Zion Temple in St. Paul, for instance, founded by exclusively German Jewish families. 1870s, 1880s, things become more difficult for the Jews of Eastern Europe. Between 1880 and 1920, nearly 2 million Jews from Eastern Europe came to the United States. Huge number, you know, transformed American Jewish community, transformed global Jewry, transformed the United States. Why did they come? Because the United States was such a wonderful opportunity for people.
So how were Jewish people treated when they first arrived in this region, and how are they treated now?
Sure. You know, again, when the German Jews arrived, and just drawing upon a little bit of the Twin Cities, St. Paul Jewish experience, but we can extrapolate from there to the entire region, they were very welcomed. There weren't a lot, and they were sort of seen as contributors to society and the like. They weren't all that much different than Americans in that sense. When the Jews of Eastern Europe came, they were far more facially, in the sense of what they wore, how they acted, the traditional Jewish communities. You know, that led, to, like with all immigrants, some difficulties, some hardships as people assimilated, as people assumed American customs. You know, became the great sort of struggle of American Jews to maintain their traditions while adapting to American mores as well as modernity, too. So you see this fascinating sort of kaleidoscope of American Jews as they become in touch with all sorts of American culture and society, and ending up with something, I think, fairly unique, and that is the American Jewish community.
Where does your family immigrate from?
Three of my four grandparents were born in the United States, so relatively deeper roots. My dad's mom, this is interesting, my dad's mom was from Poland, and she came to Fargo. They settled over in the Adriatic, ended up in Fargo. If you go to Bonanzaville, there's an exhibit on Jewish history, and my grandma's passage ticket on the Adriatic is part of the exhibit, right? And I'm very proud to have come to Fargo, North Dakota. Eventually, the family moved to Minnesota. But what happened was, in 1914, World War I breaks out, and my grandma came from a very large family, as was traditional before the war. Nobody knew the war was coming. The dad and took the two oldest daughters, and they would establish themselves and then would send money back home. But the war intervened, and my paternal grandmother and the rest of the family could not come until after the war. Yeah, so it was a real struggle to survive all those years during World War I and the war between Russia and Germany.
Let's talk a bit about what's going on in the world right now with Israel and Gaza. What is your view on what's going on?
First, a hopeful note. I had the privilege to be in Jerusalem just recently on both Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And remember, that was during the time of Ramadan. So if you're in Jerusalem on Friday, it's the approach of the Jewish Sabbath as well as the Muslim Sabbath too. And I'm happier to report, Jews, Christians, and Muslims were completing their important spring rituals, their holy observances, not quite side by side, but in the same city, in a certain amount of peace. And I saw it with my own eyes, again, on Good Friday and Easter Sunday. The Gaza War, of course, is a terrible thing to see. Innocent bloodshed is something that we have to abhor and do our best to try to overcome. And nevertheless, this was a war started by Hamas. People talk about a ceasefire. There was a ceasefire in place on October 7th. Started the war, swept over the dividing line, and talk about genocide. They were murdering every Jew upon whom they could get their hands, right? Not to mention the sexual predation, the mass sexual predation of the day. You look and see what's happening in the college campuses, the seizure of the Hamilton building at Columbia. What was the sign that was unfurled? Intifada, right? What does Intifada mean? Intifada was the terrorist activity after the Camp David Accords failed, unfortunately. that was launched against Israeli, murdered 1,000 Israelis by, you know, bombs. You might remember the bombs in restaurants and the like. What is that a call for when you see a sign that says Intifada that really means murder Jews? And when they talk about globalizing the Intifada, which is one of the chants on college campuses these days and throughout the world, that means murdering Jews wherever you can find them. So, you know, I talked about a certain amount of optimism being in this country. You also have to take great care because there are people, and this is one thing about the Gaza War too, that people have become somewhat liberated, so to speak, in what they will say now. Things that people would never utter before are now being said as a matter of politics, like destroy Israel and essentially kill the Jews. So for that reason, we live in very tenuous times.
Yeah, and go back to General Eisenhower. You know, he famously had German citizens after the war there forced to come and see concentration camps, is my understanding, and because he commented then, in years to come, there will be those who say that this never happened.
You know, the Second World War changed American Jewish life forever. You know, 500,000 Jews served in the armed forces during the war. You know, people went off to Europe or the Pacific and came back with much different views. Of course, Israel was born 3 years later, and that was also a seismic change in global Jewry as well as American Jewry. My own cousin, Sonny Cohen, was killed in action December 1944, laid to rest at the American military cemetery in Lorraine. The point being here that all Americans came together to fight the Holocaust, to fight Japanese brutality, to fight German brutality. Eisenhower had the foresight to say, you know, unless we establish this record, people will say it didn't happen. He was visiting Ohrdruf, which was a subcamp of Buchenwald, in the company of Generals Patton and Bradley and Eisenhower, when he said, he made this talk, he actually wrote to General Marshall, he said, I came here because I don't want people to say someday that this was all a form of propaganda. If you go to the United States Holocaust Museum, his words are etched upon the stone right outside the museum.
You brought a couple other items with you.
Well, first of all, here's a North Dakota hero, Herman Stern, working with Senator Gerald Nye, sort of an irony in that because he was something of an isolationist. But maybe hold this up again. My dear friend Art Phillips and Carl Oberholzer made this wonderful documentary about Herman, who sort of single-handedly helped save 125 German and Austrian Jews because he was so darn determined. Everybody knew Herman in North Dakota, Strauss, and he's a supporter of the hospitals, the Boy Scouts, the League, everything that he could possibly do. And, you know, people wanted to help him because he'd helped so many in his life, even Senator Nye, who was kind of a curmudgeon, didn't like Jews much, but nevertheless thought it was important to help Herman Stern. I always thought this was a good lesson in democracy, because why was Herman able to help save people? Because people wanted to help Herman because he'd help them. That's what the story of America is all about. And this is 1936, 1937, the Peel Commission report. Talk about a way, two-state solution, hopefully to end the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. That was the conclusion drawn by the British in 1936, that the only way to resolve the conflict between Jews and Arabs in Palestine was through division of the land, that the United Nations also accepted in 1947, in which unfortunately the Palestinian Arabs rejected at that time. You could have had two states for two peoples way back, 1947, 1948. It says right at the beginning of this report, there is no conflict in history which requires context more than the Arab-Jewish dispute over Palestine. I say Arab-Jewish because it was 1936. So all those years ago, that's what the Peel Commission report was emphasizing. And that holds to today. You need to have a deep understanding of history in order to fully understand what's happening in the Middle East.
Yeah. Can a two-state solution ever come about, do you think?
I hope so. I think it's critically important. It is the position of much of the American Jewish community, certainly the position of our organization, that the path to peace in the Middle East is with two independent states, fair and safe and secure Israel against a demilitarized Palestinian state. And events of the near past have made some doubt it, but if you could quote the first, you know, Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, when he said that to expect a miracle is what a realist does.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Steve Hunnigs with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can catch the Prairie Pulse television show on Thursdays at 8 p.m. on Prairie Public Television.
I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me.
You're listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that, too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week?
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
Main Street continues on this Monday with another Plains Folk essay from our longtime friend Tom Ezern, as he discusses the newly published book Lynched, which explores the tragic history of lynching in North Dakota. Through detailed research and critical analysis, authors shed light on 9 instances of lynching, revealing the racial and social tensions that fueled these heinous acts and the failures of local authorities to deliver justice.
This new work from North Dakota State University Press, Lynched, it's not a feel-good book. The fact that we were a nation where lynching was a common occurrence should never be forgotten or excused, say the authors, Doreen Shakey and Adrienne Stepanek of Williston. Newswoman Shakey is the author of a notable book on the Dakota War in Dakota Territory called Terrible Justice. For Lynched, she is joined by a research colleague, Stepanek, a professional genealogist whose granular research skills bring sharp focus to the episodes treated in the book. Lynching is an American phenomenon, they say. Was it a salient feature of life and death in North Dakota? Here, 9 tragic instances are treated critically as they never have been before, with serious intent and common sense. The work comprises 4 lynchings in the territorial era, 4 in the time of early statehood, often referred to as the Progressive Era, and 1 chronological outlier, the lynching at Schaefer, McKenzie County, in 1931. In 3 cases, race was a salient, maybe dominant factor. The first of these 3 is the notorious case of Charles Thurber, who, after allegedly assaulting 2 rural women, was taken from the Grand Forks County Jail and hung from the Manitoba Railway Bridge over the Red River. The bare events are scandalous. The descriptions of hilarity, malice, and general racial animus, worse. These include newspaper headlines couched in mock epic rhyming verse. Disregard guilt or innocence. The mob actions are shamefully evil. A later 1913 lynching at Mondak, which straddled the Montana state line, took the life of a black bridge construction worker, J.C. Collins, who shot 2 lawmen attempting to serve a warrant. He was a bad man, but the theft of his lifeless body by parties who threw it into the icy Missouri River hardly indicates a concern for human justice. Nor did the lynching of 3 men from Standing Rock, Alex Godot, Paul Holytrack, and Philip Ireland, the apparent killers of the Spicer family in Emmons County in 1913. They were hung from a windlass built to slaughter beeves at Williamsport. In terms of the machinery of justice, the most interesting case is that of Cleve Culbertson, the random killer of a family of 3 near Ray in 1913, ultimately taken from the Williams County Jail, hung from a bridge, and shot multiple times as he hung. This followed the trial appearance as prosecutor of the rising political star Usher Burdick, football and baseball star, formerly Speaker of the House, Lieutenant Governor, and an engaging historian who discussed the case in a memoir. Also distinguishing, or rather disgracing, the case was the anemic defense by Sheriff Carl Erickson of his prisoner against the lynch mob. Indeed, as Shakey and Stepanek observe, local authorities let down the side all over in cases of lynching. Why then were these particular Northern Plains lynchers, in every sense, allowed to get away with it? The authors ask. None of the sheriffs and other lawmen put up much of a fight to defend their prisoners. Why did territorial and state officials not pursue lynch mobs with any alacrity? The wall of silence about who might have been behind the masks was universal. Lawyers were derelict, communities failed. The authors perhaps cut the mobsters too much slack by admitting frontier conditions and a Western tradition of rough justice were in play. It seems to me the lynchings took place in communities that were not chaotic but vibrant. It happens I read Lynched at the same time I was rereading the Book of Acts at home. Students of the New Testament will understand when I say we need to read this latter-day Book of Acts and reflect on the questions its authors raise, for we tread a field of blood.
That was our dear friend Tom Ezern with another of his Plains Folk essays. Tom is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a longtime contributor to Prairie Public.
Sleepy Hollow Arts Park in Bismarck invites you to enjoy the timeless magic of Cinderella with this modern Broadway-style version, July 11th through the 20th at 8 p.m. nightly. It's live with a large cast and orchestra full of energy and talent, supported by professional lights, sound, costumes, all set in an outdoor amphitheater. Gates open at 6:30 with food trucks, games, and a pre-show by rising stars. Tickets available at Ekroth Music, most subways, or online at shtap.org.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 6 is about Native contributions. It states, Native people continue to contribute to all levels of society, from local to global, in diverse fields, including medicine, science, government, education, economics, art, music, and many more.
In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Dennis Fox Jr., enrolled member of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation, talk about contributions in the world of art.
Well, I have a degree in art, and I have a degree in anthropology. Art is a reflection of man, so we might as well study man. Why do they create art? You know that today's Indian artist, and I've always believed that they've got to compete in today's movements, genres of movements, whatever it be, cubism, pointillism, whatever it is, and avant-gardism, whatever it is, to be successful and be deemed a creditable intellectual artist, so to speak, a person that is carrying that art to the next level. And we always want to progress with that art. But the Native artist has to also maintain the tribal mores and traditions of wherever they came from. So they have to do traditional work, help the tribe, help the community, help your people, and still make a living and compete in these national movements that are going on. When somebody comes to me and says, can you do this for me? And that person may be pitiful, or we call it Gidishadzi, that they don't have much, but they need this. They want to dance. They want to do this. They want to be in a ceremony, and I need this. Okay, I'll do that for you. And then they come, and they say, oh, I came for that. And is it finished? Yeah, it's finished. I got it. All you have to do is pay me. And that gift or that payment just may be a little bit of tobacco or cigarette, and that will pay for that piece of artwork.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Donald Trump promises to cut green energy subsidies and spend on oil and gas. We ask what he might actually do on climate if he wins the election. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us on this Monday on Main Street. Tomorrow on the show, we'll meet Daryl Richeson, the new North Dakota State climatologist. Richeson, who also serves as the director of NDSU's North Dakota Agricultural Weather Network, brings over 30 years of professional meteorological experience to the role. Richeson's career includes weather forecasting in all regions of the country and for various regional television stations. We'll bring that your way Tuesday on Main Street, and we hope that you'll join us.